And it's great to know that there's this Sangha down here that's so powerful. And you know, I get the newsletter, and just to see all that's going on down here. The Buddha said that the whole of the spiritual life is noble friends and noble conversation. So you should count yourselves very lucky to have so many noble friends with whom you can have noble conversations. So why do we die? I don't mean like, you know, cancer or heart disease or step in front of a bus. I mean, why do we die? I mean, who made up this game? I mean, you get born and that's traumatic enough, and then you could do the diaper thing, and then you do the teenage thing, and then you go to work for 40, 50 years, and then finally you can relax and you die. I mean, that doesn't seem really efficient. I mean, what's going on here? Why does it work like that? It doesn't seem fair. It's certainly not how I would have put it together if I was doing it. I don't think any of you would have come up with a plan like that. Why do we die? What's going on? I mean, are we doing something wrong? Maybe there's something extra that we have to do that we haven't been doing. You know, like what if we got a bunch of crystals and we put a lot of crystals? No, wait, they already tried that. I think actually the New Agers tried most everything, you know, extra to do to keep from dying, and they still seem to be dying. Maybe it's not that we have to do something extra. Maybe we're doing something we shouldn't be doing. Do you realize that 90% of the people that ever ate are dead? Maybe we shouldn't eat. You know, if we... No, that doesn't seem to work either, I don't think. But maybe there's something that if we didn't do that, we wouldn't die. Well, if we didn't get born, we wouldn't die. I mean, you don't get born, you don't die. You get born, you die. It would appear that birth is a necessary and sufficient condition for death. Of course, that only changes the question. Why do we get born? I mean, if being born means you're going to die, why bother in the first place? But yet, we get born. In fact, not only us, but all sorts of creatures. Everywhere, there's all this borning going on. There seems to be this absolute urge in Mother Nature for things to get born. Spring will be here not too long away. I mean, it's just a little over a month before spring officially arrives, and there will be borning happening all over the place. The flowers, the trees, the birds, the bees, everybody's going to be out doing this borning thing so that they can die. It all seems very strange. But there is this urge out there, this urge to become, this becoming urge that seems extremely prevalent in nature. It's just there. So this becoming engenders all this birth, which leads to death. So what's this becoming stuff about? Where does the becoming come from? Well, now if we look at this building, it didn't used to be a building, and then it became a building. It used to be just, you know, some wood and some sand and some water and some metal, you know, and they mixed it all together, and, well, they put the water and the sand and the cement together, and it stuck together, and they made the bricks, and they put stuck these boards up here, and they stuck the nails, sort of like sticking things together makes the becoming, this ability of things to cling together makes things become. The becoming seems to be dependent upon things clinging together. I mean, if you just had all the raw materials and you put them in the parking lot, you wouldn't have a building. if you dumped all the raw materials right on this spot, you still wouldn't have a building until you put them together, made them stick together in the right way. So this clinging together of things, this clinging, seems to lead to the becoming, and becoming leads to birth, which leads to death. All right, so where does the clinging come from if it leads in this direction? Well, what are the things that I tend to cling to? I tend to cling to things that, you know, I really kind of like, you know. I don't want to lose them, you know. I cling to my car keys. I cling to my nice laptop computer. I cling to my hot tub. I cling, you know. You've got all your stuff that you cling to. These things that you really don't want to do without. These things that, that we sort of crave. You know, if it's not something that we really care about, and we may not put a lot of effort into hanging on to it, but if it's something that we really do care about, if we really sort of got to have it, then we put a lot of energy into making sure that we've got it. We hang on to it pretty tightly. So this craving seems to lead to the clinging, which leads to becoming and birth and death. Okay. Craving. Where does this craving come from? Well, sometimes I crave chocolate. Now, I crave chocolate because I like chocolate. You know, I'll be sitting there doing something and it's like, oh, I've got to have some chocolate. You know, this urge to have it comes up, this craving, this, you know, I got to get it. And so I get some chocolate or ice cream or whatever it is that I've started to crave. And, you know, I start eating it because, well, it feels good to eat it. The taste is really good. Or, you know, I'm at my job and I just had enough. I crave to go outdoors, you know, to get out of this windowless, cubicle-filled room and go outside where there's some fresh air, where, you know, it's a little bit cleaner and brighter and not so congested. It feels nicer outside. So it would appear that my craving for whatever I crave is dependent upon the feelings that are produced by the things that I crave. The feeling of the taste of the chocolate or the taste of the ice cream, the feeling of the nice fresh air and the sunlight. It's these feelings that seem to lead to the craving. Okay, so where do the feelings come from? Well, I put the chocolate in my mouth and I taste it. There is sensory input from the taste buds on my tongue, and this sensory input produces a pleasant feeling. Or I go outside and the air is nice and fresh and it feels good on my skin and it feels good in my lungs, and this sensory contact with the nice, clean, fresh air produces a feeling that I like. So it would appear that our feelings come from the sensory input. Okay, so where does the sensory input come from? Well, the chocolate comes out of this little wrapper, but I think in a more general sense, the sensory input just seems to come. Out in the world and there is sense contact. It's all pervasive. You walk down the street and there are thousands of sense contacts coming at you. You go into your house and you sit down and there's still all these sense contacts. There's what you're sitting on, the feeling there, the sounds, your stomach growling, you know, you get hungry, you put the food in. I mean, and you open your eyes and you look around and there are so many sense contacts that we can't even be aware of all the sense contacts there are. So these sense contacts lead to these feelings, which lead to these cravings, which lead to clinging, which leads to becoming and birth and death. All right, so what's really the origin of the sense contacts? Just basically being alive. We have sense organs that are out there sucking in sense contacts. So the sense organs, by their very nature, seem to produce the sense contacts. All right, so where do sense organs come from? Well, if you've got a mind and a body, you've got sense organs. If you just got a body and you got no mind, well, sense organs aren't working. And if you just have a mind and not a body, well, I don't encounter many people like that, but you still wouldn't have sense organs. So it would appear that if you have a functioning mind and a functioning body, the two working together, then a sort of outgrowth of that is the sensory contacts that enable you to interact with the world, the senses that enable you to get the sense contacts to interact with the world. So it would appear that our sense organs are simply an outgrowth of the fact that we have a mind and body. You look at an amoeba, now it doesn't really have sense organs, but it is aware of light and heat and food, and you know, it's got rudimentary abilities to sense. It doesn't have quite the sophisticated sense organs that we have, but basically things that are alive have the ability to sense what's going on in the environment and react to them. The plants grow towards the sun. They send their roots down to where there's water and nourishment. So they have this ability to sense the environment. So being alive, having a mind and body, in order to stay that way, you've got to have senses, which have sense contacts, and having sense contacts seems to lead inevitably to feelings, and feelings tend towards cravings and clingings and becoming and birth and death. All right, so mind and body, where does that come from? Well, it would appear that mind and body are dependent upon consciousness. If you're not conscious, then, well, having a mind and body is not really something that, well, you're aware of. You're not conscious of it. So you've got to have consciousness to have a functioning mind and body. Consciousness seems to be sort of the synergetic sum of mind and body. But also consciousness seems to be necessary for mind and body to work. You put mind and body together, you've got consciousness, and yet if you don't have consciousness, I mean, like you're unconscious, having a mind and a body is useless. So it would appear that mind and body are dependent upon consciousness, and yet consciousness is an outgrowth of having a mind and body. That the two are interdependent upon each other, that we've got all these things leading backwards step by step to get to mind and body, which is dependent upon consciousness, and yet consciousness is also dependent upon mind and body. This is the Buddha's teaching on dependent origination. These are the various links, the steps of dependent origination. And I presented them to you this morning in reverse order. Usually they're presented in the opposite order. And I gave you 10 links, and often they're talked about as the 12 links of dependent origination. If you read the suttas, the discourses of the Buddha, you find dependent origination talked about in a number of different places and in a number of different ways, and often presented forwards and backwards and both forwards and backwards. You find the number of links varying anywhere from 6 or 8 or 9 or 10 or 12, depending upon, well, the formulation in that particular sutta. The Buddha, when he gave his discourses, tended to give them to the level of understanding of the people that he was talking to. So sometimes he would simplify things, and sometimes he would make them quite complex. Also, the suttas weren't written down immediately upon the Buddha's passing. They weren't written down for like 300 to 500 years. They were kept as an oral tradition. Now, if you've ever played the game of telephone or gossip, where I whisper something to the first person and they whisper it to the next, and it goes around the room, and when it finally gets to the other side, what that person heard bears no resemblance to the original sentence. You can imagine 500 years of oral tradition trying to preserve 17,000 different discourses of the Buddha. Things probably got a little bit changed over that period of time before they were written down. And so some of the different formulations of dependent origination that you find in the suttas could be an outgrowth of that, as well as the Buddha presenting dependent origination in different ways for different audiences. Now, the traditional way that's presented with the 12 links going in the other way starts off with ignorance. And you sometimes can find Tibetan tankas, Tibetan paintings of the wheel of dependent origination that has little illustrations for each of these 12 links. Usually the way this wheel is depicted, in the center there is a pig, a rooster, and a snake, each biting the tail of the other. And they represent greed, hatred, and delusion. Let's see if I can remember which is which. I believe the pig is delusion, because the pig lives in the mud and thinks it's paradise. The rooster is greed, and the snake is hatred. I think that's how it's formulated. But anyhow, so in the center you have these three animals in sort of the bullseye position that represent greed, hatred, and delusion. And then next around that, there are the six realms. And this is where the artists who do these paintings really get to shine. There are the six realms. There's the hell realm, the realm of hungry ghosts. The hungry ghosts are beings that were very greedy in their previous incarnation and now have been incarnated with huge bellies and very tiny throats, so they can't get enough stuff. Then above that realm is the realm of the warring gods, the asuras, and they're always fighting. And you have the animal realm. We probably have seen this realm, the human realm, and then above that, the various god realms, which are all lumped together into one panel of this painting. And so the artists who paint these wheels of dependent origination usually spend a lot of time painting all the various realms, the hell realms being painted in a way that would make Dante very happy, and, you know, the hungry ghosts with their big bellies and their little throats, and the warring gods looking like a bunch of guys from the Pentagon or something. And the animals and the people, and then the various heavenly realms where, you know, everybody's hanging out and having a good time. And then the outer rim is where these steps of dependent origination are depicted. And as I say, the first one, it's usually depicted with 12 links, and the first one is ignorance. And that's depicted with an old blind person trying to make their way through the forest. If we're ignorant, we can't really know where we're going or what we're doing. Ignorance leads to karmic formations. If you're ignorant and you act in a way that produces karma. And some of the karma is good and some of the karma is not so good. And that's depicted by a potter sitting at a wheel making pots. And some of the pots are very nice and very beautiful, and some are misshapen and some are broken, representing our karma some of which is very beautiful and some of which is not so beautiful. So ignorance leads to karmic formations. Karmic formations lead to consciousness. Consciousness is depicted as a monkey swinging from tree to tree. You might be a bit familiar with monkey mind that swings from thought to thought. Maybe you've experienced that sometime in the recent past, perhaps even. Consciousness leads to mind and body, which is depicted as two people in a boat. One is standing and is pulling the boat along, and the other is lying down in the boat. The mind is the one standing and pulling the boat. The body is along for the ride. Mind and body are two, and mind is in charge. Now, sometimes it may not seem like that. Your body does things that your mind didn't want to do. But in general, the mind is in charge. Usually when you find yourself going into the kitchen to get something to eat, you're not surprised. Where am I going? Oh, what's happening here? I mean, your mind thought, I'm hungry, I'm going to get something to eat. So in that sense, the mind is more in charge. It's the one that makes decisions. Okay, so this mind and body that we have has five external sense organs and one internal sense, the mind which thinks. And that's depicted as a house with five windows and a door. So we have the sense organs, and there are sense contacts, and contact is depicted as a couple embracing. And then from the contacts, we get feelings. And feeling is depicted as a man having arrows shot into his eyes. Unpleasant feelings as well as pleasant feelings. The word feeling shows up quite a lot in the Buddha's teaching. The Pali word is vedana, and the translation of it as feelings in English is not a particularly good choice. We tend to think of feelings as emotions. When you're reading what the Buddha had to say, when you come across feelings, you should remember that it's a very basic, I like it, I don't like it, I don't care. Pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It doesn't really mean emotions. The emotions come at a more complex level. So when you see the word feelings, in general, it's a translation of the word vedana. And vedana is just simply, I like it, I don't like it, I don't care. So this man having arrows shot into his eyes is having a very unpleasant vedana, very unpleasant feelings. Now, from the feelings comes craving. The Pali word for craving is tanha, which literally means thirst. I don't know if you've ever been really thirsty. I remember hiking in Australia and running out of water. It was a big river I could drink from. The only problem was it was like 100 feet down the straight down cliff. And I knew I would get to a spot where I could get down, but that last 45 minutes with no water and it being, you know, 95 degrees and very dry was most unpleasant. I was really thirsty. So this is what follows from the pleasant sense contacts. We really want it. Often when people are discussing Buddhism, they say, you know, the root of all of our troubles is desire. That isn't what the Buddha said. He said it was craving. Now, desire very frequently leads to craving. But if you can desire something and not get it over into craving, that's not going to be a problem. If you desire something and you don't get it and you don't care, well, what's the problem, right? You didn't care. I mean, you know, it'd be kind of nice if I had a drink of water right now, but, you know, it's okay. I don't care. But if I really want a drink of water and if I don't get that drink of water, I'm going to be upset. Well, then I'm upset. And that's where the dukkha comes in, the unpleasantness. Right? So the craving is the thing that leads to trouble. The craving leads to clinging. When you crave something and you get it, you want to keep it. Now, If it's something unpleasant like having arrows shot into your eyes or the pain in your knee or the rainy weather, you crave to get rid of it and you crave to uncling it, to make it go away and stay away and not ever come back. Okay? So the clinging can be clinging to having it or clinging to having its absence. Craving is depicted as someone sitting at a table and eating lots of food, and clinging is depicted as someone picking fruit from a tree and putting it into baskets which are all full and the additional fruit is overflowing onto the ground. The clinging leads to becoming. The becoming is depicted as a pregnant woman. Becoming leads to birth, which is depicted as a woman with a very tiny baby. And birth leads to death, which is depicted as a corpse. And these are arranged in a circle around the six realms. And then the whole wheel of life is held by Yama, the Lord of Death, who, very ugly head, is over the top of the wheel, and you can see his hands clutching the edges and his feet clutching the bottom. And so if you get a chance to see one of these tankas, examine it and look at the 12 paintings in the outer rim. This was the original teaching, and all the rest of it is the art that has evolved over the years to, well, make it prettier. But the real teaching is these 12 links. Now, the normal interpretation of the 12 links is that the first two links of ignorance and karma is your previous life. And so from the out of ignorance, you created certain karma, which has now led to this consciousness, this mind and body that's having these sense contacts, has these senses, has these sense contacts, these feelings, these clingings, and these cravings, which will then lead to a future becoming and a birth and a future death, which will then, of course, lead to more ignorance because we don't get to remember all the stuff from the previous life and more karmic formations, and the wheel just keeps going. Now, this is a valid interpretation in the light of the Buddha's teaching on rebirth and karma and so forth, but although this is the interpretation that's most generally given, this is not the most important interpretation. The most important thing is to see that this dependent origination happens all the time. Let's take, for example, a mango. I go to the Safeway. I never had a mango before. I'm in the produce. I'm looking for bananas, and I see mangoes. Oh, yeah. Mangoes, I've heard about them. They're supposed to be very delicious. And so I buy a mango. Don't have a clue what I'm doing, but I get one that's ripe. And I get home and I go, well, I guess you got to peel it. And I manage to get it peeled. And I cut it away from the big seed in the middle. And it's like all juicy. And then I bite into the mango. Okay. At that point, I have a mind and body that's conscious. I have the sense organs. There's the contact. The mango hits the sense buds. There's the feeling. Ooh, that's delicious. I want some more. This is really good. In fact, I'm going to tell my friends Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice about this. They don't know about mangoes, and after I turn them on to mangoes, they're going to think I'm a really wonderful person. In other words, I'm going to get some ego support. What we're giving birth to at this point is not another incarnation, but we're giving birth to the ego. And because the ego is such a fragile, nebulous illusion, we have to keep giving birth to it all the time. So we live in this world where we have a mind and body and sense organs and sense contacts, and there's this craving and clinging going on that we use to support the ego. So it's very important to see dependent origination happening on a moment-to-moment basis. Every time there's a sense contact, there is a chance for it to run off into craving, clinging, becoming the ego. We give birth to the ego, and because the ego is very fragile, it dies, and we gotta give birth to it again. Now, the Buddha before he was the Buddha, was a prince who wanted to know, why is there old age, sickness, and death? He wanted to know, why do we die? Okay? Now, you can imagine, here's this guy, he's been practicing austerities for 6 years, and he sat down under this tree on the full moon night in May in India, and he's made this vow that he's not getting up until he figures out why there's old age, sickness, and death. He's got to ask himself, why do we die? Okay? And he's going to figure it out, or he's going to die, right? He's not getting up from this spot. So he asked himself, what is the origin of old age, sickness, and death? And his answer was, just being born. If we're alive, then we experience old age, sickness, and death. It just comes with having been born. Now, this is indeed the, well, last link of dependent origination if you go in the 12 order. But it's also the first noble truth. The four noble truths are a summation of dependent origination. And the first noble truth, life contains dukkha, is simply the summation of, if you're born, then you're going to die. Then you're going to experience old age, sickness, and death. In fact, in the suttas, quite frequently, the link of death is spoken of as pain, grief, lamentation, sorrow, and death. Old age, sickness, and death. So all the dukkha that shows up in the world comes because, well, if you're born in this world, that's just what's going to happen. Now, the Buddha's real genius, the breakthrough that he made, was to discover that it's possible to break out of this cycle that keeps going and going at the point between feeling and craving. There actually is a lot that goes on between the feeling, the taste of the mango, and the craving, I've got to have some more. Okay, and that's not talked about in the teaching on dependent origination. It's talked about in a lot of other places in the suttas, the mental formations that come along and all this other stuff. But what the Buddha saw was that prior to the feeling, what happens is happening pretty much on automatic. We can't do anything about being conscious and having a mind and body with sense organs and the sense contacts coming in and the feelings being produced. The feeling part of the brain is the old brain, the reptilian part of the brain. We don't have any control over it. Okay? Something sharp sticks you in the hand, it's unpleasant. You can't really control that. But the Buddha's discovery was we can control it between the place of feeling and craving. And this is the second and third noble truths, that the craving is what really gets us in trouble. And the third noble truth, learn to quit craving and you won't have this dukkha. Okay? So once it gets into craving, it's really difficult to stop it from going on to clinging, becoming, birth and death. So the key teaching was to get out at that point. So this is the Buddha, the night of his enlightenment, sitting there contemplating old age, sickness, and death. It comes from birth, it comes from becoming, it comes from clinging, it comes from craving, it comes from feeling, etc. And figuring out that the way to make the break was to learn to quit craving, to catch it some point between when the feeling arises before the craving sets in. There are several accounts of the Buddha's enlightenment. It's given from, shall we say, different viewpoints of what he experienced that night. And if you look carefully at them, it would appear that what the Buddha did that night was got himself very well concentrated. He did the meditative absorptions, the jhanas. And once he was well concentrated, he turned his concentrated mind to an insight practice, specifically to contemplating dependent origination. And he was able, because of that, to make a breakthrough in consciousness that not only changed him, but he was able to make it known to other people and explain to them how to make that breakthrough in consciousness. The essence of what he discovered that night is the teaching on dependent origination, which gets summarized as the Four Noble Truths, the explanation in the first three, and then the fourth one being the eight things to do to learn to quit craving. The Buddha said that if you want to see the Dharma, then you need to see dependent origination. And that if you see dependent origination, then you see the Dharma. This is an extremely important teaching. This is the underpinning. This is the foundation of all that the Buddha was saying. So I hope what I've said today maybe sheds a little light in that direction. And I think we have a little time for questions, comments. Yes.
One of the things that's a fairly common question, but I still don't have my mind around it. You talk about desire separate from craving. Mm-hmm. To me, it's a matter of quantitative versus qualitative difference. But you speak of it as if it's qualitative.
Right. In general, I would say it's qualitative in that if you desire something but you're not going to be upset if you don't get it, then there's no problem. But if you desire something and you're going to be upset if you don't get it, then there's going to be a problem because you're going to be upset if you don't get it. Now, whether you're going to be upset or not does seem to be quantitative. But the quantity at some point makes the shift in quality. Okay, so if you've got a little desire and it's no big problem, then the quality is it's okay. But if you've got a lot of desire, well, then it turns into craving and it's going to lead to problems.
So in, from some perspective, it is a matter of quantity. I desire something a little bit, I'm a little bit upset if I don't get it.
Well, no.
Or a lot, that I'm very upset. And you're saying at some point...
I'm saying at some point that early on it's possible to desire something, and if you don't get it, you're not upset at all. Okay? And then other points...
If I interject, my feeling is I'm upset just a little bit. Because I want desire a little bit, right?
Then you crave... Then I'd say that the word is craving rather than desire.
So if I desire something, even a little bit, and I'm only a little bit upset, then it is still craving.
It's a little craving, right.
So my question, which is fine, my question then is... For me, it's hard intuitively to think of desiring something and not, at some level, a lot or a little bit, being upset if I don't get it by the nature of the fact I desired it.
It is possible to desire something and, you know, if it doesn't happen, it's okay. I woke up this morning and they had promised me in the weather forecast it wasn't going to be raining this morning. Well, they're right now, okay, but coming over here at, 8:30, it was raining pretty good. I wasn't upset.
But no part of you was at all, even a little bit?
Well, it was just a matter of I had to drive over here. I wasn't putting any energy into worrying about that. I was worrying about that big truck in front of me. So I wouldn't say I was craving for it to be sunny this morning. I sort of desired it, and when it wasn't a big deal. I don't think I suffered any from it. So I think it's possible. It's not easy. And that's why it's very problematic to start indulging your desires, because as soon as you do, it quickly shifts over into craving.
I think what people use as an example, instead of desire, is the word preference.
That yeah.
If you have a preference or something, like you like this, but if you don't get it, it's okay. Then, that's safe. But if you've got to have it, then craving.
Yeah, for me, maybe it's just me, but it's still a different term, but it still has the same sort of train of thought. If I have a preference, then either I'll be a little bit happy if I get it or a little bit less happy if I don't, because it's my preference.
That's right.
Sort of a tautological, if you will.
Yeah, I'd say that really what we're discussing here is a little bit of semantics, and the key thing is to realize that if you've got this, I'm going to be upset if I don't get it, feeling, then... technically you're into the craving part, and it's going to lead to dukkha. Even if you get it. You had a question?
You can't just take us to this big mess and then stop short of telling us about that eighth path, maybe.
Well, I'm sitting there looking at the clock. Okay. The Eightfold Path. The Buddha said, basically, there's three parts. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. Morality, concentration, and wisdom. The Sila is how we behave. And those three, there are three parts of the Eightfold Path that address that. And they are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Right speech is telling the truth, not using divisive speech, not using harsh language, and not indulging in idle chatter or gossip or frivolous speech. The right action is defined as not killing, not taking what is not given, no sexual misconduct. And right livelihood is earning your living in a way that doesn't harm anyone else, that doesn't involve lying and stealing and killing and sexual misconduct. The right concentration is the four great efforts. They are to recognize an unwholesome state of mind that has arisen and make it go away, to recognize an unwholesome state of mind that is about to arise and prevent it from arising, to recognize a wholesome state of mind that's about to arise and make it arise, and to recognize a wholesome state of mind that has arisen and to make it persist and develop to its fullest. The next in the samadhi, the right concentration part, is right mindfulness. There are four foundations of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body. Mindfulness of the feelings, that is, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Now you can see why that's important. If the idea is to not go from a feeling into craving, you want to pay attention to the feeling so you can catch it before it runs off. Mindfulness of mind states. That is mindfulness of the emotions. Am I happy? Am I sad? Am I angry? Am I desiring? Am I upset? Am I confused? Am I sharp? Am I clear? And then the fourth foundation is mindfulness of dharmas. Dharmas being teachings of the Buddha. In particular, mindfulness of is the factor, the one of the seven factors of enlightenment is equanimity. So is the factor of equanimity present in me? If so, how did it arise? How can I maintain it? Or the teachings say of the five hindrances, is the hindrance of anger present in me? If so, how did it arise? How can I make it go away? How can I prevent it from arising in the future? So knowing the Buddha's teachings and then applying them to your particular, how you're living at the moment. The third of the three things of the Eightfold Path for right concentration are the jhanas, the meditative absorptions, which I don't have time enough to go into, but they are eight altered states of consciousness, each one leading to more concentrated state of mind. Then you take your concentrated mind and you turn it to knowledge and vision of things as they are, and this is where you gain the wisdom. And there are two parts to that, which are right view, and right view is the Four Noble Truths. Right view is dependent origination. And right thought, or perhaps better, right aspiration, which is thoughts of renunciation, of harmlessness. That is, not being greedy and being helpful to people. So that's the Eightfold Path. I have a whole long talk on that.
Is there a connection between the six realms and dependent origination steps? I mean, they were the center of the schematic. I'm trying to draw some... connection.
Basically, the karmic part is the connection. Karma is intention. The Buddha said, karma I declare, O monks, is intention. So whatever we intend will produce actions, which is the literal translation of the word karma, and those actions will have resultants, karmic resultants. And that will lead us into the various realms. Now, you can see the six realms as, you know, places where you reincarnate, or you can see the six realms as existing right here, right now. I mean, the human realm and the animal realm, yeah, we can see those. And you can go to that five-sided building just south of Washington, and you can see the Asura realm, the warring gods realm. And you can go to downtown San Francisco or Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, and you can see the Hungry Ghost. I was just in India. I saw some people that were living in hell. You know, you can encounter people that are living in hell. And occasionally you run into people that are just, you know, things are going really, really well. They're actually living in the Deva realms. So, and it's a result of karma. It's a result of actions. Now, there is our personal resultants and so forth from our personal actions. But there's also all the ongoing karmic resultants of just, you know, all our forebearers. The fact that we are born here in this place where we have a lot better access to the Deva realms than some poor guy who's born in India to beggar parents is, again, karmic.
These realms aren't linked in a sequential process like the dependent origination steps, but it's simply
there is a sequence, hell being the worst. The hungry ghosts next, the warring asuras, the humans, the animals, the humans, and then the Deva realms, of which I think there are 27 specific ones given. And there are various things you can do that will put you into each of these realms. Killing a Buddha, that will put you in the hell realm. Learning the eighth jhana will put you in one of the Deva realms, so forth. When I was at Wat Swan Mok in southern Thailand, they spoke of wise wishes and foolish desires. So I put that under the wise wish thing. However, one of the Buddha's principal teachings is to not hold to fixed views. In other words, you're not going to be able to put a ribbon around it. That you need to understand it, but if you really get it to the point of a fixed view, that's not going to serve you. Okay? These are all fingers pointing at the moon. And don't get too attached to the finger, you know, putting rings on it and painting the nail and trimming it up. Okay? Just, you know, see what it's pointing at. Gain the understanding of it. The other thing is that, in particular, dependent origination does not lead itself to being wrapped up. The best sutta on dependent origination that I know is number 15 in the Long Discourses. And that sutta opens with the Buddha's attendant, Ananda, coming to him and saying, "Venerable Sir, this dependent origination appears to me as clear can be." And the Buddha says, "Do not say so, Ananda. This dependent origination is very deep, and it's by not understanding dependent origination all these people are having all these problems." And then he gives this great discourse on dependent origination. I keep learning more and more about dependent origination the more I hear about it and talk about it and read about it and reread the discourses that I've read before. So it doesn't lend itself to being wrapped up very tightly. And as the Buddha said, fixed views generally tend to get us into trouble.
I keep thinking about watching my kids over and over again on that slippery slope of feeling and desire and craving. And it seems like maybe that's what childhood is all about, adulthood too.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering about applications of this to, as a parent, if you or anybody else has advice about those moments when you see your kid and they have to have it and the impulse is so strong, and then they bring you into it as, you know, a power figure to make it happen or not. How to bring some of these concepts into those moments?
At those moments, it's going to be really hard because thinking back to my own childhood, I don't have any kids, so I can't, you know, say, well, do you do this? But thinking back to my own childhood, when I was craving something, That was it. I was totally caught in that craving. It was just like completely. And then I got it. I remember, you know, getting the perfect toy on Christmas morning, and I was so happy for, you know, an hour or two, and then it was in the closet and never played with it again. The time for the teaching is after they've gotten their craving thing and they arrive further down the line and see that it wasn't totally fulfilling. And then you've got to be very skillful. You can't just say, well, what about that thing I got you that you never play with anymore? You know, because then they're going to be very defensive. But you're going to have to look for your opening when they actually are not set. They're aware of their non-satisfaction with this thing that they crave so much. And that's your best chance to present this sort of teaching to them. But when they're caught in the midst of the craving, they're not going to listen to you. They're just going to know that you're trying not to spend the money. And it's their job to make you spend that money. And, you know, but it's actually when they're feeling that dissatisfaction, you know, they were really into it and they really wanted it and they really got it and it really didn't turn out so good. You know, it can be anything. You know, you collect three cereal box tops and you send $1 to get this wonderful thing and it comes back and it's not even worth the 33 cents postage to send the box top, let alone the dollar. You know, at that time you point out how they got you hooked with the craving. And the craving doesn't lead to fulfillment. That's your best chance, rather than when they're totally in the craving. And it's also our best chance, too, because when we're in that craving, we don't see it either. We know that if we get that nice new BMW, everything is going to be just fine. It's only when the insurance bill comes that you maybe can think about it.
I guess thoughts, so it's hard to say this, but there's something about the word action. You know, when you have a feeling, positive, negative, and neutral, and then that's the point where you're supposed to maybe stop it.
That's the gap between the feeling and the craving. There's a lot goes on in there.
Okay, but we need to take action because we're born and we can't just sit or our tissues disintegrate.
Right.
So, you know, there are evil things in the world or things that are not good for beings. And things need to be done. And so in order to take any action, you need to have a desire. And if it's just too tempered by equanimity or something, I mean, you wouldn't do anything. You have to almost have a craving. If there's injustice or something, you have to have a craving before you're going to move.
Generally speaking, to get started, yes. But hopefully, as we learn, as we go along, we can get to the point where we have the desire for this injustice to stop. And we do what we can do. We do the absolute best that we can. And if it doesn't work, then we've gotten to the point of going, well, I did the best I could, and it didn't work. That is, it's very much do the right thing and don't be attached to the results. It's very much do the right thing. You have to figure out what the right thing is and you have to go do it. The teaching on the four supreme emotions of love, compassion, joy at the good fortune of others, and equanimity says, if you truly have love, then if you encounter suffering, you will act with compassion. But if you have equanimity, which is not indifference, then you do your best, and if it didn't work out, you know you did your best, and that there was nothing else that you could do. So it's that trick of getting to the place where you can do your best, give it your best shot, and not be attached to the results, and that's hard.
But what I want to say is that if it's something big, like the ecological crisis, you can't just do your best and then say, I tried my best. You have to get craving again and say, I need to do something more than, until you're dead. You basically need, there are certain things that we need to do that won't stop just because our first action.
Right. If you do your best, and it didn't work, okay, you've done your best. Now you've got to find something else that you can do your best on. Yeah, just because you do your best one time, it doesn't alleviate you from trying again. However, you'll be more effective if you can do it where you're not coming from a place of craving, where you can really hang in there and just keep doing it because it's the right thing to do, rather than doing it because I've got to have this result. And that requires the equanimity part. And it doesn't have to have the craving for the result. For it to work most effectively, it needs to be motivated by the love of the planet and all the beings on the planet, and recognizing that we can't do these ecologically unsound things. And so that it comes from love rather than, we've got to shut down the oil drilling in Alaska. It's rather, it's for the love of the environment rather than this specific goal. Now, yes, preventing Bush from opening up Alaska for oil drilling is a wonderful thing to do, and we should all do our very best. And if we fail, then we got to find something else to do our very best on. And if we succeed, we've got to find something else to do our very best on. So the trick is not being attached to the results. Because if you get them, well, there's always some idiot out there about to do something else you've got to go prevent. And if you don't get them, well, you don't want to be that upset. You, because the upset is not going to help you when you've got to go stop something else. So the trick is, and it's not easy. None of this is easy. If it was easy, we'd all be enlightened. I mean, if you got up this early on a Sunday morning, you know, you're dedicated to your spiritual practice. It's just hard work. And so you just keep doing it. But the trick is to do it out of love and rather than out of attachment to the results. But what gets us started often is this ideal of, yeah, if we can do this, this will be great, and we'll accomplish this goal, and we'll save this. And but as we mature on the spiritual path, hopefully we work just as hard, but our motivation is more out of love and not so much attachment to the results. That's the goal. I think this group is great. I think I do Dzogchen practice, but I also do Vipassana practice as well. Okay? I do exactly the same practice you do. And I do jhana practice, which is strong concentration practice. I think this group is great. I've, you know, talked to a lot of people in this group about their spiritual practice. I love seeing the depth that's, you know, growing in this group. And I think it's wonderful. You've got a great teacher. I very much admire Gil. And I think this group has a wonderful future. I love seeing the energy that's coming with it. And, you know, I could move to the peninsula and wouldn't feel I was bereft of, you know, a great Dharma group. So I think it's great. So it's 11 o'clock, which I believe is your stopping time. Thank you very much. It's been great sharing the Dharma with you.